Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So we are going to pick up tonight and hopefully do tonight part of chapter 2, as we take our time kind of going through the chapters of Esther, at least most of it tonight, and see we'll get where we get. There was a phrase in Greek that originated about this time period we're covering. It's poignant to tonight's chapter. An oine aletheia in Greek. An oine aletheia. I don't know if any Greek scholars in here, but in wine, truth. Okay? We know it better if you know the Latin, maybe you've heard it, or if you're a Doc Holliday fan from Tombstone, in vino veritas, right? That means in truth, and wine, truth. This originated in this period because of the Persians' indulgence with wine in a way that the Greeks blushed, okay? Which is saying a lot for a culture who openly drank, gorged themselves, forgive me, had vomitoriums where they ate, made themselves throw up, you know, disgusting behavior, and they would judge the Persians. Aeschylus was a playwright you may have heard of. I mentioned him a few weeks ago. Aeschylus was a playwright that originated one of the first divisive plays, writing a play that was secretly about the people yearning for Xerxes' father to be back, because Xerxes was really pushing things. And that phrase, in vino veritas in Latin, means in wine, truth. But there's a second part for that that we cut off because the first part sounds cool. But it's in vino veritas and aqua sanitas, which means in water, good health. Now, what on earth does that mean? In wine, there is truth, but in water, there is health. What does that mean to you? What do you think? What is he saying? Well, healthier to drink water than wine. So, but we drink wine, we tell the truth, we're more loose. That was a cultural thing, and it's why I mentioned a while back that in Xerxes' banquet, their culture, I mentioned just in brief, that you know the Greeks would make fun of them and say, they drink wine without watering it down. The Greeks said, at least slow down and pour some water in it, buddy. And they would get toasted. Xerxes would hold a banquet, they got wasted, and they would come up with all these ideas, let's go to war. And then they would sleep it off, and if they still thought it was a good idea while they were sober, they'd go ahead. Xerxes was the exception in a way, too. He was going to get his way. And I say this tonight because it was again in chapter 2 now. We're past the banquet, the first banquet of many. And now we're dealing with one problem that we still will deal with today, a lot of people. What happens when the party's over, the hangover's raging, and you remembered you just banished your wife? Okay, we're going to look at chapter 2 tonight and look at a few things. And we're going to finally get to our heroine, Esther, introduce who this woman is. And we've talked about Xerxes on the throne there. We'll get to Haman. He'll get his time later. But we're going to learn about Esther tonight, hopefully, with time permitting. So if you'll go ahead and turn to Esther 2, we'll get there in a moment. Tonight, we're going to look at these two characters of Esther and Mordecai. We're going to see how God moves his queen into position. And I do not mean to trivialize this like a chess match, but I do like that analogy. I like this picture of a queen, there's another queen, a king in the background. It truly does feel like it. And I would submit to you, this is wonderful of analogy because God is playing 4D chess here. God fired a bullet a long time ago that's going to hit its target. There's no putting it back. He's going to win. He has a people who are in exile. He said it was going to happen, but he's on his way getting them back, all towards Jesus. I'm going to talk a bit more about the symmetry of Esther, and I want you to think tonight we're going to talk about, again, how it's funny how Xerxes In the story, he doesn't listen to any of the women in his life. There's a lesson for every husband. Listen to your wives. But he listens to no women. And in his case, he should have, because he probably wouldn't have had these problems. Esther is the most even-keeled person in the story, and he finally listens to her later. But it takes a while. We're going to talk about a little about Esther in chapter 2 is the choosing of the queen, but also Esther choosing how to go about it. I want us to talk a little more about this beauty pageant they had to go through and make sure we really understand the stakes here. We're going to have a new queen crowned by the end of the chapter. It took us a chapter and a half to get here before Esther's even mentioned. Conspiracy in the palace is briefly mentioned. It's a story, very dramatic. And God is setting up his winning move. God is moving pieces into position. This is where we start or should start to pay attention or need to start to pay attention. That this is what providence is all about. There is no coincidence. I mentioned this diagram before, and one thing I forgot to, I think I did a bad job of, is scale. Now, this is a very high bird's eye view of the palace at Susa. Very high. We're going to look at a couple of these places tonight. There's only three real places we're going to focus on. At the top of the map, you'll notice number one. That is the Apadana, the main courtyard. This is where the banquet happened. I feel like maybe this, we don't know how high up this is, so I want to give you some scale. Has anybody ever been to the Biltmore Estate? You know that? Ever been to that? That number one would fit the Biltmore. That's how big. And this is the small palace. This is Xerxes' Susa. He was the king of kings on earth. Persia was an empire that no one had ever seen before. So let's be clear here. These weren't people living in sticks and tents. This was a fabulous place by earthly standards. I want to say somewhere around 130,000 square feet or something fits this one area. Imagine columns you could fit a dozen men around that stood 70 feet tall. That's how tall this place was. Xerxes' might. This is where the big banquet happened. And there's, you know, a picture of the Biltmore. If you've ever been there, just imagine the Biltmore. Clear out everything inside. That's the dining area. Pretty big. These giant columns, each one topped. If I looked here and I was standing, if this was on the, these are all ruins now. They've got some of these at the British Museum. And if you stood here, your feet would line up here. You'd probably, this is about 6 feet, okay, to this first little roll. Those stood on top of a 70-foot column. Now imagine 40 of those in a massive building, all being judged by the double bulls that represent the might and virility of Xerxes. That's what we're talking about. Imagine Esther having to go through all this. She didn't just walk next door, okay? When Esther has to do some of this later, it's very intimidating. Some of the coloring I wanted to mention, I've mentioned a couple of these before, but I want you to picture as we go to the palace tonight. In the first chapter, he describes blues and ivories and gold. It was pretty. It was blue and yellow. There's a winged bull. It was beautiful. The palace was a stunning sight. In these three places, I meant to change those numbers, but we're going to be here. This is where we left off from the banquet. And tonight, as we read Esther, the king's gate, way over here. Okay? The gate of the heavens, they called it, the king's gate. Mordecai and the harem is number three down here. Massive area to itself, connected to Xerxes' throne room for ease of access. Four reasons. I'll let your minds wander. The harem is not a good place. I want to be clear. It's not a love story. It wasn't a good place to be, even by ancient standards. Persian women were very progressive for their time in very good ways. Had jobs. They did some good things that were very good. Could own property. But in some ways, the harem life was very, very bad in every way. So the party's over. Just in quick review. After chapter one, the war banquet is over. Vashti has been told to come no more before the king. And a decree was given saying everyone will give honor to their husbands and the man shall rule his own house. Now, not getting into spirituality here, but it was kind of fixing a problem that didn't exist. Ironically, Xerxes causes here civil unrest that didn't need to happen, okay? He's upsetting the family homes. The men are upset at home because they're being told they're being lied to. The Persian households were impacted, and I want us to remember as we remember the queen, we don't know for sure if Vashti was Amestris. I mentioned her. Queen Amestris was Xerxes' queen. It may be that she's never in the story. She was the mother of Xerxes' son. That's what mattered in their society. But history tells us Vashti is probably this woman. We have all these rankings of women I went over last week. You know, you didn't want to be down here per se, but Esther was made queen in this chapter. She's really more of a concubine or a queen consort, just above a concubine. But you never could really fire the principal wife. That was an arrangement by politics. So Vashti's probably still around, but she's in one of the lower houses now. And we'll talk about that in a bit. I talked about how the word in Hebrew is malakah for queen. Hebrew does not delineate. We don't have a good idea. We don't have the Persian word. We just have to read through the lines. It means queen, but I want you to remember it really just means wife of the king. Those are two different things, right? It kind of is. She's not really autonomous. She exists because she's his wife. That's why she's important. Let's remember that. So let's not give the Persians too much credit for liberating our homes. We see that Esther is made queen here in a few minutes. And I want us to remember this. Again, I mentioned this already. We have some evidence we'll look at later. We know that Vashti was probably banished to somewhere else. But let's go ahead and read in the time we have. I want to start with verses 1 through 8. But I mentioned that about the wine, because even the Greeks thought the Persians needed to calm down because it caused a lot of problems. Because when you get drunk, you say a lot of things maybe you wish you hadn't. And Xerxes is no exception. So we see a new queen is needed because of Xerxes, and we're going to meet our heroes. So chapter 2, if you'll read with me, the first 8 verses. After these things, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. I will stop there. That second part reads very much as a child knocking over a vase and saying, someone did that. It's funny that Vashti did something, but somehow she was vanished. Then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, and to the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. We're going to unpack this in a minute. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, the Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. You'll recall we went over that in the first week, the history that got us here. He was bringing up Hadassah. Here we go. That is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about, when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa in the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace, into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now, if the banquet's over, I want us to see there. I mentioned this before. You know, the Greeks again mocked the Persians for their drinking. But after these were over, meaning once he was not drunk anymore, let's translate, right? When the wrath of Xerxes was appeased, i.e., now he's just hungover, he remembered Vashti, whoops, and what she had done, and what was decreed against her. Whoopsie. One thing we notice about Xerxes, and I want us to remember, just to list a few verses, I hope your mind goes here. Let's think about what the Bible says about alcohol, right? Don't do it. There's a reason why. Hopefully there are others you think of. Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Check. Wine is a mocker, stone drink a brawler. Whoever is led astray by it is not wise. Check. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. Check, check, check. And I want us to pay attention to the Proverbs, the wisdom literature. It's interesting how Esther is going to embody that literature. That we see the Hebrew Bible refer to wisdom as a woman. We see Esther embody a tradition now that they have no more temple to worship at. They're in exile. But Esther somehow has a tradition that's alive. And she is embodying the Hebrew scriptures to get us to this point. In the first verse, I want us to think about this as well. Xerxes, when it says he remembers, Xerxes remembers. Maybe it's guilt, shame, we don't know. I'm not trying to speculate. Anxiety, what do I do now? Probably, because again, politics, okay? He's made some family upset he's going to have to pay off. This is very Game of Thrones. This is someone's line he's going to have to pay off. What do we know in the Bible that comes to mind when God remembers? Have you ever thought about when you see the phrase God remembers? Does anyone have a verse that comes to mind? Or what generally happens when we see the phrase God remembers? Anyone? Hannah. He remembered Hannah. Samuel. Who else? Pardon? Noah. Good one. Anybody else? Israelites in Egypt. He did. We're in a period of exile. God is silent, but not really. He's still there. He's always been there. God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham. Look at all these. God remembered Noah. I thought that he remembered Abraham. He remembered Hannah. So good. That's what I thought of. He remembered us when we were down. His love never quits. What's the difference here? When God remembers versus Xerxes, did God forget? What does it mean? Why does it tell us God remembered? What does it mean when God remembers? What's he doing? What do you think? He's going to take action because he's a covenant fulfiller. He doesn't forget. He remembers when we see certainty and positivity. Favor is granted. He gives grace. He says, I remember. Because of you, I will do this thing. It's not just the past. There's a lesson here in the first 8 verses about the company we keep for application. Simple lesson we tell our kids, but Xerxes, you ever notice in these verses, every time he does something, who does he turn to? Hey, what should I do? What should I do? Turn to my advisors. We don't know. It says in the first chapter, he turned to the wise men, which we know in Greek is magoi, the magi. This is where we get that tradition. And that's what part of Esther's appeal. We see a tradition. You can call it coincidence. I call it providence. We have the Persians preserving Jewish history because of Esther. We know in chapter 2, I don't know what your translation said, but mine says the king's attendants. We don't know from history. This could be the same people. They attended him. The eunuchs, someone mentioned the first week they weren't curious about the eunuchs. The eunuchs, of course, were men who had been castrated to serve in the women's harem. The Persians said that a man that could not desire after someone else more than their king was preferable, right? They wanted them to protect them. Harsh. What we know in chapter 2, it might be the eunuchs, we're not sure. It might be the hakamim, the wise men, in Hebrew, or the magoi in Greek. It was customary. But I want us to think again about these verses. We won't dwell on them long, but I hope these come to your mind. They did me. You know, we see about wisdom, about the company we keep. Bad company ruins good morals. That's a New Testament one. But think about the Proverbs. Esther would have known this. Iron sharpens iron. A friend sharpens a friend. Who's Esther's companion? Mordecai. Family. She leans into her wisdom, right? Doesn't panic. For wisdom is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire compares with her. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. Now, I mention that because we're going to see Esther in a minute very much not lean on her own understanding. She goes with the flow. Esther is one of the best examples of what happens when we just let God, right? That's all she can do. And she's different than the other women. And I would submit to you that's what's happening. So I want to mention something here before we go on, something you may be familiar with, maybe not, that I'm going to challenge you to think about for the rest of this quarter. There's a text, call it God is not here, or is he here? You won't see this in an English textbook, but it's a very classical idea in Hebrew and Greek of a text. You know about past tense, you know, I run to the store, I ran to the store, that kind of thing. They had something called the divine passive. Anybody have any idea what that means, the divine passive? What do you think? Just throwing a curveball at you. Anybody ever heard that? I'm going to put something silly here. I'm going to ask you a question. I promise I'm getting there. If you see this sentence, and I say, let's say you know enough English to be dangerous, right? And you say, the dough is risen. What are we talking about there in your mind? What do you think I'm talking about? Tell me. What's that? Bread? Baking? Okay, I know what bread is. Dough. It's risen. So it flies? Does it rise up? No? What do you mean by risen? Is risen? Well, I need to know some other stuff, right? In English, well, yeast, and it goes in. Well, you got to tell me more. If you look at linguists that talk about the divine passive, basically it boils down to this. In Hebrew and Greek, this is much like how in Greek we have all these wonderful words for love, agape, amore. They understood that. In Hebrew and Greek, they had a tense of a verb in one word. It encompassed what I'm about to tell you. Whereas in English, it takes you 3 or 4 pages in a textbook to explain, well, if you use this adjective, because our language stinks a little bit when it comes to this. Now, the reason I picked is risen, because this is, I think, the best example. You ever remember this verse from Luke? The Greeks adopted this, and the Greek writers were Hebrew. You know, they were writing this down. He is not here. Everybody have different, I wrote down about 8 different translations of this verse, 24:6. He is not here at the tomb, right? For what? For he is risen. Your translation might say, but he is raised up. He is raised up. But raised up. He has been resurrected. He has come back to life. He has, you see the difference? Now, they're all right and they're all wrong. What's the difference? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you see what's kind of different here? Why did we translate it this way, do you think? What is the verse saying? The divine passive, when they would have this word, the word was he arose. But the true Hebrew word was saying he has been raised. Because it's implying God is active here. It's passive. They developed it because the Hebrews do what we should do. We throw around the word, any name for God, a little too much. It was reverence, right? We don't want to say his name, even if it's right, because to say it is to sully him. And you see in Hebrew texts, the word, and I know it sounds like a little thing, but it's not. If you read the original text and you go and look at some concordances, it'll tell you it's this weird passive voice, because it implies when they heard it, Jesus was raised up by God. He's working. You know, the dough and the bread rose because something made it. Does that make sense? And I challenge you, every time you see a passive verb in Esther, it's a way to include theological and grammatical voice to capture the reverence of God. God without saying his name. And this kind of cut it off. There are a couple of verses that say that. You know, the man arose and took up his mat. The verb isn't he got up on his own. It's saying he arose because God did it. Does that make sense? I'm not making this up. Look it up. It was the way they conveyed, because God, that's why. They got it. We have to search for it. If you see a passive verb in Esther, which we just read one, when it says Esther was taken to the king's palace and she found favor, she found it because she was put there. Does that make sense? That's what it reads. I know it sounds simple, but they had a different word they would use if it said, well, Xerxes sent his guards and took her to the king. The verb is saying, no, she was taken there. She was taken there by God. Does that make sense? So I would tell you, when people say God's not here, he very much is. And they were clever. The Hebrew writer uses it. Every time you see it, it's a divine passive. Except for when it isn't. When Haman does things, he did it. When Xerxes does things, he did it. When Esther does things, God put her there. Now, God is at play in all these, but I hope that makes sense. So I'll challenge you the rest of this chapter and quarter. When you see that, read it in your mind as, this happened because God made it so. Because, guys, that's what the text says. Providence and not happenstance. Any comments so far you'd like to chime in on or throw a tomato at me? Any thoughts on that? The word is vatilaka, was taken to, but unconjugated. It is taken to by God. I think I messed this slide up, and I apologize. So I want to go on as we look at these verses in verse 3. And it mentions Xerxes sent out overseers in all the provinces. So at least 127 women, okay? Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of that in history. The Persians, I told you, were really bad at writing it down. They did keep animals. Because it's like if Becky wrote a paper and somebody burned it up and I wrote a paper that cited it, You'd have mine. You'd have to trust me. That's what we have. The Greeks were really good about it. We can thank Alexander the Great for that. In about 150 years, he burns all this to the ground, except for the clay tablets, which is what makes all this work. Top five biblical archaeology discovery. I'll show you in a second. But we see Haggai is a eunuch in charge of the women and the cosmetics. Now, this is always something that, for me, was interesting. One thing I'll mention, these are just some snapshots, and you can't read them, but they're these little tablets, and it's something still going on. You can look it up, the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute. Thousands of these were discovered, and they're still trying to decipher them. But we've deciphered a lot of them in this world, and Mordecai's in there. The eunuchs are in there. Haggai's in there. Were there other people named that worked in the palace? Sure. Were there other people that worked in the palace at that date and it's written down? You believe that? Got some beachfront property to sell. Yeah, no, right. So, records of visions for the women of the palace. We have these things called the fortification tablets. Mounds of receipts. Boring stuff, okay? It's basically stuff that keeps records. They were good at that. How many people were with Xerxes? What did they eat? How many grains, whatever did they get? So the fortification tablets tell us the things that match Esther. It mentions the women of the palace, not the royal women. There's a different word. The women of the palace meant the concubines. We have records that Darius and Xerxes both had a harem, and we have the receipts where they went grocery shopping. We know how much grain they gave the women. Cosmetics. They wanted them pretty and smelling nice. And to be honest with you, a Persian court, we think about ancient civilization. Compared to the Greeks, it was probably pretty nice. The Persians were obsessive about cleanliness. Their banquets would have smelled pretty good. The Greeks made fun of them to show you how a culture changes. They actually mocked the Persians in their writings and history for two things, show you how men and women change over time. They mocked them because the Persians were effeminate because they wore pants. Kind of funny, huh? History changes. They wore pants, riding. The Greeks thought that was how womanlike. And they don't even vomit at their dinners. They bathe multiple times. How lewd. How bizarre, right? A time to think. But the Persians were very clean, and they were Zoroastrian in their religion. We mentioned that before. They believed in good and evil, pure and defiled. Now, this wasn't God and Satan, but they believed in ritual cleaning. And for the women, especially so. But this wasn't a good thing for the women. These were porcelain dolls being shined up for the men to do as they wish. So if you ever read anything that talks about the harem, they were not honored. It was a terrible process for these women. 12 months of rigorous chemical application. They were state property in the harem. We have records. Once you got in the harem, you didn't get out. I want to be clear. This was not something, if you were called to the harem and didn't go, they killed you. And we're going to talk later when we get to Haman, when it says they hanged them. We don't really have evidence they hanged people. Not in the way we think. They hanged them in another way. Not good. We'll get to that. But there were rituals the women would go through. We have multiple non-biblical sources that confirm. They would be prepared. Then they would go to the second house of the women. Think of a holding area. Sounds like cattle, if you read it closely. They were basically moved through these houses. And then they got to go to the king, if they were lucky. They had one night. One night with the king. If they impressed him, they moved up. If they didn't, sayonara. You lived the rest of your days until you were too old to have worth in the lower house. Never allowed to marry. That's it. You've been blessed by the king, though. It's not a good life. We see Herodotus corroborate this. I say him a lot in this class. A lot of history corroborates these practices. We know the eunuchs were called the custodians of the women, as you'll notice in chapter 2. Haggai is the custodian of the women. Again, Josephus mentions him. Haggai was in charge of the beauty regimens, the diets, and the supplies. A chief eunuch was in charge of making the women eat the right things, wear the right perfume, feed them well, but not too much. Don't get chubby. These were not women anymore, right? This is why Pam and I were talking about this the other night. You know, she observed that how many times does God refer to Israel when they fall as prostitutes? You prostitute me before the other nations. sexual immorality, not because God is saying, shame those women. He's saying, you're violating a marriage, a covenant. Sex and marriage and beauty are wonderful things. And if you defile that, you've broken the worst covenant, faithfulness. We know that when, we know that Herodotus tells us, at this time, Xerxes sent a decree to bring in all the daughters of the families of the provinces. And I want to talk about Esther now a little bit in the time we have. Now that we've got the characters. So we're about to see Esther be purified and win the crown. The word for Esther, unlike Vashti, and this cut out some letters, and this is my fault. I'm going to have to watch what I'm pasting. The word is Ashtar. You may have heard the word Ishtar or Ashtara. And a lot of commentaries say, oh, it's the word for star. And it does work out to be the word for star, Ashtar, in Hebrew. The problem is, I don't think that's true. Because if you look at the text, it's spelled differently. Hebrew uses an A at the beginning called Ashtar. That means something different. You remember the Babylonians and the Persians gave different names to their people. Daniel became Belshazzar. You don't hear a lot of, well, you hear some people named Mordecai and Esther today. But those were Persian names. But because of what they do here, the Hebrews embraced it and took ownership. We know that Esther's name, she was either the cousin or uncle. Someone back here mentioned that the other day. We don't really know. Different translations, it's hard to tell the relationship. Cousin or uncle of Hadassah or Hadassah. She was an orphan. So not only was she a Jew, she was an orphan. Ain't looking good for Esther. Not in any society. She was lovely and beautiful. We know that. It sounds phonetically like a star, which means to hide or conceal. Hadassah is the name we have. We know it's a Jewish name, and it means myrtle. I always thought that was funny growing up. Myrtle doesn't exactly invoke, sorry for any myrtles in the room. It doesn't invoke runway model in my mind. Neither does Michael, I guess. But for this time, it was a specific type of myrtle tree found in this area that brought joy, life, and healing. It's a beautiful name, Hadassah. It was an herb, an ointment. Maybe that's her name. But I don't think so. That was her Jewish name. The thing is, this is a stele of some of the very few things with women on it found in the harem. We could see a woman being served by other women. Very few things survived, such as necklaces. And they had beautiful jewelry. It's for another class. I can't go into it, but these are beautiful. But we know it was Ashtar, but it wasn't star. Esther, you see, was branded with a name, and it was one of their gods, just like they did to Daniel. And Mordecai was too, I believe. I think Mordecai had a different name, we don't know, because it matches the way they named. And I'm telling you what I think and what a lot of commentaries think, and it matches, it makes sense. Mordecai and Haman, neither one of them. Those are both Persian names to humiliate and subdue. Right? Now, Ashtar is actually its origin is Assyrian or Babylonian. And if you went to mine and Adam's class last quarter, we talked about this. Ashtar is short for Ashtar, or Ashtara, or Asherah. Remember the Asherah poles? She was given the name because of a goddess of lust, sexuality, and carnal behavior. There's a name at the bottom I've put there in Hebrew that is not Ishtar. It is Ayisbael or Jezebel. And I submit to you the symmetry of Esther, which is really clever of God. Isn't it interesting that we have a tale of two queens? 400 years prior, an evil queen comes down, and I struggled. I'll be honest with you. I tried to pick a picture that was not offensive. At the bottom is something where at least there's a semi-clothed woman on the statue. The Asherah statues are not very safe for work, very sexual in nature. This is actually a seal of Jezebel when she ruled, it says Ishbael. And I mention her because that culture continued. It's interesting to me that I could read those bullet points and be describing both Jezebel and Esther. You ever thought of that? Foreign queen with a pagan god's name, check. Married to a foreign king, check. Ahab, Xerxes. Used her influence to sway the king. Jezebel, Ahab, we're worshiping Baal now. Okay, Esther, going to get there, was at least indirectly responsible for at least one man's death. Check and check. Haman's going to get it. Beautiful, powerful, and devoted to her God. Check, check, check. I think it's interesting that God is playing a long game, that 400 years prior, an evil queen comes in, wrecks the family unit and the nation, and brings them down. And you know what God says? Bet. Gotcha. You know, he says, 400 years later, I'm going to use a queen to put them back. Isn't that cool? I mean, it is me. Think about it. God could have done this with anybody. And I think it's interesting at this time, he says, okay. You think you can beat me on the plains? He tells these people hundreds of years earlier. If we don't fight God in the mountains, we can beat him on the plains. You think so? Let's fight. We'll take him down with a queen, destroy the king. Sure. Think I can't win with a queen? That's God says no. It's a long, long time, but it comes to fruition. So I want you to think about Esther as she bears the name of a beautiful but lustful goddess to make sure she knows her place. And she will be a sex object for this king. But she makes a decision to be a lot more than that. Mordecai is similar. We know Mordecai was short for Marduk or Mordecai, which was another god they had. He, like the other men who worked in the palace, and we know Mordecai was in the palace. His name is on the fortification tablets as well as an attendant of Xerxes. It's in there. We know he was the of the tribe of Benjamin, and that's going to come up next week when we talk about Haman. Because your assignment, I want you to read 1 Samuel. And maybe you'll remember now before we get to verse 3, but Saul was tasked to do something to a group of people, right? The Amalekites, who were ruled by King what? Do you remember? King Agag. Guess who Haman's descended from? Haman the Agagite. God is righting a lot of wrongs in this chapter. Just look for it. When God says he's going to win, he's going to do it. Mordecai, again, we have lots of images that capture other gods that he was supposed to. Mordecai was like a dragon god, named after a god of chaos, and we know he was there. So I wanted you to be aware. We're getting low in time, so let's at least read these next few verses, and we'll do some more next week. But I want us to think about the next half here. So we'll read a couple of these verses and close off at a good spot, but I want us to at least get a little deeper. So we have the decree, and we're going to see in the next six verses a little more about harems, and we'll have to get to more of that next week. But in verse 8, so it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. This is the eunuch, not Xerxes yet. So he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and the maids to the best place in the harem. She got moved up a spot. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go to the king, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices, and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything they desired were given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shazgaz, which was another eunuch, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and is summoned by name. So we'll close tonight with time. I want you to think about this next week. I want to talk a little more about the harem and about why Esther is hiding her heritage. I'll give you a hint. You know, if you've ever wondered, these 12 months that the women went through, they used myrrh and oils to scrub their skin chemically when they found residue of these things to make them lose their hair, a little bit on their arms. And the myrrh was mixed with other things I guess when we close, I do want to ask, anybody ever thought about why they waited 6 months or more? They administered the chemicals in case they were pregnant. So the Persians would take myrrh and other chemicals, and they had a six-month waiting period where they would be treated. And it essentially was either a contraceptive to make sure nothing happened, but also to abort any children that the king may have to deal with. We don't talk about that, but that's what these women are going through. Let's make sure you're not spoiled goods before you see the king. That's the translated version of what the Persians said. So these women were treated very poorly, and Esther's about to have to go through this herself. So we'll pick up there next week. Thank you all for your time.